Earlier this summer, I hosted a five-day virtual summit that was about navigating the future of entertainment. And I had some of the most amazing conversations with some of the most brilliant minds that I've ever met in my 10-plus years of podcasting. Now, when it comes to navigating our uncertain future as artists, as creatives, and storytellers, I do not pretend to have all the answers. And frankly, I'm not sure I have any of them. But what I can promise is that few are working hard to try and figure out where we are going next and how it is that we stay relevant while also staying sane. The following is my summit interview with best-selling author and world champion poker player Annie Duke. And we talk all about how we can make better decisions and decide if we want to stick it out or if we want to quit and pivot on a completely different path. So Annie, I want to begin by first saying that I must have done something right, because the last time that you and I talked, I met some bar, some expectation, because you said, I guess I'll do this a second time. So I just wanted to start by thanking you for being with me the second time doing this conversation. I'm really, really excited for the insights you're going to bring to me and my audience at the summit today.
Well, I feel like, to be fair, that's more my bar, because you asked me back. So
I did.
We can fail mutually about that.
We can certainly fail mutually. And I would say that you not only met, but you vastly exceeded my expectations in our previous conversation.
That's very nice. Same
but then
to you.
It begs the question, and I had a very similar conversation with Christina Wallace, who's a part of day one of this summit. But I had the same problem with interviewing Christina that I had with you, which is we didn't talk that long ago. It was only two and a half years ago. So I could very easily just send somebody a link to our conversation. Right. But I would argue that we're going to have a completely different conversation in a different universe than we did just 2 years ago.
Let's try.
Yeah, shall we try? So do you think it's worth you and I having a follow-up conversation, given maybe a thing or two has changed in the last 2.5 years?
Well, you know, what I find for myself is a few things. One is that I teach. So by the way, if people want to take a class from me, you can go to maven.com. It's actually really cool for your audience. It's actually an amazing site. There are creators who are just like doing classes, whether it's on like AI or go to market or sales or product or whatever, like anything that you can imagine. There are people who are experts in that field who are doing classes. Mine is on decision making. That little sort of ad aside, it's interesting when I'm working with students that the way that I talk about things and the way that I kind of think about things and the way that I frame things does evolve. So very often I'll find that the way that I was talking about even the same topic a few years ago will be different than the way that I'm talking about it now. So that's kind of the first thing. But then the second thing is that, you know, I keep going. And so I'm in the middle of writing another book. That's a totally different topic. And, you know, that the thinking that comes from like what I'm doing in terms of my writing at the time will also seep into the way that I'm framing things from the past or, you know, and then the work that I do with my clients will change the way that I'm thinking about things. So I feel like I could be talking about the exact same topic. And if you talked to me a few years ago, I'm probably thinking about it differently. I probably have different examples. I'm probably framing it differently. I hope. We'll see.
Well, here's what I think has changed from my end as far as the work that I've been doing for the last 2 to 3 years, what's going on in my ecosystem. When you and I had this conversation about better understanding the psychology of quitting, do we grit it out? Do we stick it? How do we learn better frameworks for decision-making? How do we understand and recognize some of our biases and the way that we're wired, these blind spots? The world in which we had that conversation was such that all of the people that I worked with were coming out of the pandemic, out of the Great Resignation, and all of us had this moment to pause and reflect on our life's choices. Mm-hmm. So this is a very voluntary conversation. Is this the life that I want to lead? I have a choice right now. Do I want to stick with the work that I'm doing? Do I want to stay on this path? Or do I want to choose to quit and go in a different direction? I think the difference in the context of why I wanted to talk to you today is because that choice has been removed. And the industry and the world has quit on us. Technology mm-hmm. is changing so fast that our entire paths are disappearing. The future, there's so much uncertainty about where we might go next. So it feels like such a luxury to send them a link to when we were talking 2 years ago and they'd say, frameworks sound good. I can't apply any of this because there's choice. So how do we start this conversation about asking whether or not we should stick with something or quit specifically in our career paths, when now we're forced to make these kinds of decisions and it's no longer a choice?
Yeah. So, gosh, there's so many places to go with this. It's such a good question. Let me think how to tee this up because it's so good. Okay. So let's sort of think about the transitions of the past few years to how we got here. One of the things that I've been hearing a lot from people is, oh, the world is so uncertain now. How am I supposed to make a decision in this very, very uncertain world? Which I think is, you know, adjacent to what you're asking about. And my response, and I'm really not being snarky, I'm being serious, is the world was always uncertain. You just can't ignore it now. And that's like they're sort of like taken aback. But if you think about, you know, before the pandemic, or even, you know, 22 to 24, people kind of thought things were the way they were and they were going to stay the way they were. And we're really good in those moments of kind of over-indexing on the certainty, and that like somehow you have this ability to know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next week or the next year, you know, that the world isn't going to like shift from underneath you that quickly. So one of the reasons why, like at that time, you know, because I was writing Quit in a time where there was, you know, some more certainty, was that I was trying to get people to understand, like, no, you actually do have to think about your path and how things are going to change and what the opportunities might be. And you need to be prepared for the thought that you might have to quit, because things do change. And after you start things, you do learn new things, and we tend to be not very reactive to them. And you ought to start reacting to them better. So that, let me just use that as a setup to where we are now, because so that's kind of point number one, is that we're always making decisions under uncertainty. There's always going to be luck, things that are out of your control. A lot of what's happening, for example, with technology is out of your control. You can't control, you know, tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs on, tariffs off. Like you can't, and I assume you're not making those decisions. So you can't do anything about that, right? You can't do anything about AI. It is a thing. You can make decisions around AI, but like the existence of AI and the advancement of AI and things like that, like that's not something that you're controlling just as much as you're not controlling world events. So those things are, that's always going to be the case. There's always going to be luck. And then there's going to be things that you don't know. Our knowledge of the world is actually quite limited compared to if you were omniscient. And what that means is that after you start things, no matter what it is, no matter whether you're in a time where you feel like there's very high certainty, which there's not, that's a delusion, or you're in a time where it feels like there's a lot of uncertainty, you will learn new things after you start things. That is just true. So you may learn new information, which gives you that feeling of, I wish I had known then what I know now. I might have made a different choice. And people may be feeling that in regards to like career choices and sort of what's happening in technology and, you know, whether there might be a recession on the horizon or whatever it might be, that oh, I wish I had known, you know. And then, you know, sometimes there's just going to be bad luck. And that will tell you that you wanted to have changed. In a time where we feel like things are more certain than they are, we tend to be very non-reactive to those signals, right? So this is, we had talked about this last time, that we tend to get very stuck on the path that we are. But then when things are very uncertain, we tend to get stuck for a different reason, which is that we get paralyzed. So we recognize that the future is very hard to predict. Like all of a sudden, we sort of have to face that reality. It's almost like, oh, did you ever read like the original Wizard of Oz?
I have not.
The original books.
It's funny because I was just going to reference pulling back the curtain to see the wizard and my follow up to this. So continue.
Yeah. So, okay. So in the original books, the Emerald City was not green. It was beige or whatever, stone colored, but to go into it, you had to put on green glasses.
Mm.
So you look, someone pulled the glasses off of all our faces right now, right? So what that means is that we sort of understand in a way that we don't necessarily before, because we suffer from a few biases. One is illusion of control. That's a really important one, where we think we have much more control over the future than we don't, except now, right? Except for in this circumstance where uncertainty is dialed up to 11 and the green glasses are off and we can't really ignore it. And that actually causes people to get paralyzed, and they find it very difficult to make decisions under those circumstances. I would love, and we should dig into it, I would love for people to see that as actually an opportunity.
And that is why I invited you to the summit, is that exact perspective. I would not have guessed, I'm not a betting man, no pun intended, a little bit of a pun intended, but I wouldn't have bet that less than 10 minutes in, we would have had a mic drop moment. But I want to repeat this for everybody. The world was always uncertain. We just can't ignore it anymore. And I have been seeing for years the opportunity in this, and people see that as sacrilege. Like, how can you be talking about all of this chaos and uncertainty and people that are losing their jobs and their livelihoods? How can you be so optimistic about, oh, all the things in the future? It makes me look like I have no empathy. I have the opposite. I have too much empathy. Like, yeah, it literally drains me, but I'm always looking for the opportunities amidst crisis. And this is the opportunity that I've been seeing, that I've been screaming from the rooftops. At least now we see the game that we're playing, because we had this illusion that there was a path, that there was certainty. And we were trained by the assembly line of the Industrial Revolution to believe that this existed. At least now we know that it's all bullshit. And now they've pulled back the curtain. We now have the green glasses off. I love that analogy. Now we at least know what the game is, and now we're starting to learn the new rules. So you and I are exactly on the same page with this.
And the thing is, like, honestly, this particular type of dislocation has repeated over time. So you mentioned the Industrial Revolution. That was a big dislocation for a lot of people. You know, there was the first computer revolution, right? Where you had, like, you know, word processing all of a sudden. Like, think about that, right? Like, what was that, right? Like, you had, you know, you have all of a sudden you have radio. Like, I mean, you have washing machines. You have, like, all of these things are, you know, can be very disruptive. Like, these big technological advances can be very disruptive. You know, we carry around phones. That's really different. Think about the poor person who was building phone booths, by the way. That really sucked for them. Or, like, the person, I remember when I was in, when I lived in New York a long time ago, there was, I think his name was Aaron, the king of pagers. He did not do well with the change of technology. You have a company like Blockbuster, right? Did they survive streaming? No, right? It's just that these things, you know, these really big things, which would be more like industrial revolution size things, we can see those sort of microcosmically all the time happening, right? So streaming was a big disruptor. It was a big disruptor to a lot of people. But the reason why I say, okay, there's an opportunity in this, is that, let me lean on poker a little bit here.
You can lean on poker as much as you like. It's a core part of your identity. So use it at your will.
So here's the thing about poker. Poker is a game of decision-making under conditions of uncertainty. I don't get to see your cards. Bummer. And I don't know what cards are to come. Okay, so there we can really see the sort of, there's a bunch of stuff I don't know because I don't know my opponent's cards. And then there's luck, which is the random deal of the cards. Okay, but that deal is actually random. Right. So over the long run, if you're playing poker and I'm playing poker, we're going to get dealt the same cards over time. Right. If you have a large enough sample size, we're going to get dealt the same cards. That doesn't mean on a given night, I might get dealt on average better cards than you do. But we know that's going to regress to the mean. It's going to go back to equilibrium. And so we're all sort of poker is interesting because we're all kind of dealt the same hand in that sense. OK, a little different than life, but, like, let's just start there. Mm-hmm. So we're all kind of dealt the same hand. And then we're all making these decisions under extreme uncertainty. None of us can see each other's cards. None of us know what the cards are to come. And the question is, who's embracing that more? Who's making decisions under those circumstances more? Making decisions under those circumstances better, rather. And the people who are able to operate better in that system are going to do better. And some of that has to do with a total and utter willingness to fold your cards in spots where other people wouldn't, but also an understanding of when you're supposed to change tactics, when you're supposed to strategically change, you know, when you're supposed to really stick to a hand and go for it. Like, how are you modeling your opponents? How are you modeling the world? How are you thinking about how your opponents might be changing? So that what you're ending up doing is kind of two things at once. And I would love for people to start sort of thinking about it this way. It's kind of, what do I know and what don't I know all at the same time? So I think that people think that the game of poker is a game of trying to reduce uncertainty, meaning that I'm supposed to know more than you. And we all think of that scene in Rounders, if people remember it, where Matt Damon is like watching some sort of home game of like his professors or something like that. And he literally names exactly what all those people are holding. It's like, you have Jack 10 and you have two sevens and you have what it's not what it's like. No, nobody's picking it out exactly. We're all leaning into the uncertainty and trying to sort of understand, like, what do I know? Like, how narrow can I get that range of cards that you can have? But understanding never too far, because if it's too far, you're going to be in trouble. When I'm playing against somebody new, what would be called my confidence intervals are wider. So what that means is that I allow for more possibilities for the hands that you might be holding than someone whom I might know better. And that's actually going to make me a much better decision maker, because I'm going to be more flexible in the sort of thoughts that I'm holding in my head and the way that I'm going to arrange my betting in order to accommodate a wider range of hands that you could be holding. I just want to stop here for a second, because that was a lot. Is that making sense so far?
This is absolutely making sense. What I want to make sure that we do is bring it back to, how does this actually apply to?
I'm about to. Yes.
And I know that you're getting there. So I wanted to allow you that pause.
Yeah, but I just want to make sure that that's making sense.
No, I love that we're setting the table with kind of right. All these ideals, but I you know, obviously want to bring it back to, that's great, I don't play poker, so what right. What do we
so
actually do?
So now we're
going
to bring it to regular life, okay? So when I say, when I'm playing against somebody new, my confidence intervals are wider, meaning that I'm holding more possibilities in my head and then designing the bets that I'm making according to that wider range of possibilities, which is actually going to give me a much better edge, right? And then as I sort of watch the world unfold, I sort of change my mind a lot, right? That's the situation we're in right now. As uncertainty goes up, you have to set your confidence intervals wider. That's all you're doing, right? And so that shouldn't be scary to people. So instead of saying, I don't know, which is what people feel like now, right? You should instead say, I know less, would be a good way to put it. So what happens is that when we're, say, pre-pandemic, people are like, I know everything exactly. That's bad, because it's not true. Now people are like, I don't know anything at all. But that's also bad, because it's not true. Instead, what you ought to think about is that when things feel more stable, when there's more certainty, my confidence intervals can be narrower. And a confidence interval is just, what's the lower bound, what's the upper bound of the thing that I'm trying to predict? And I'll do a fun little example with you in a second to try to get to this. When there's more uncertainty, or when you know less about something, or when there's more influence of luck on the thing that you're predicting, you have to set your confidence intervals wider. And what that's supposed to do is appropriately represent what you know and what you don't know. So let me just do a fun game to kind of ground that, hopefully.
Please. P.S. By the way, I love the way that your mind works. Continue.
It's just, yeah. Ooh, okay. All right. So I assume you have never seen my dog.
I have never seen your dog.
Great. What does my dog weigh?
I have no idea. Probably less than 500 pounds, but I don't know.
Okay, so you don't know. That's your answer. So you recognize, like, you haven't seen my dog. There's a lot of uncertainty. And your answer is, I don't know. This is what happens to people in these situations where it's hard to ignore that you don't know a whole lot, right? Okay, but let me ask you a question. What if I demanded from you your best guess of what my dog weighs? What would you say?
85 pounds.
85 pounds. That's actually quite high compared to most people. Okay. What's the lower bound of what my dog could weigh?
15.
What's the upper bound?
I mean, I don't know dogs, but if we're talking Great Dane, probably 120 maybe.
Okay. So it's interesting because you did say in there when you said, I don't know, you did say, I don't think your dog's going to weigh 500 pounds. Okay. Well, now I know you don't think my dog's going to weigh 500 pounds because you gave a lower bound of 15 pounds and an upper bound of 120 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually know a lot about dogs. I mean, this is the lesson in this, right? Because you didn't guess 500 pounds. Why didn't you guess 500 pounds?
Because there are no dogs that exist that are 500 pounds.
No. So, but think about, like, what do you think, like, the Empire State Building weighs?
Wouldn't even know where to begin with that.
I mean, tons, some sort yeah. of
many ton. Metric shit tons, I'm sure, is the measurement.
Exactly. Metric shit tons. That would be the technical term for it. So things can weigh a lot. Like the range of things that can weigh, you know, things can weigh is like light as a feather up to like the earth, right? Which is very heavy. And yet you were able to narrow it down to 15 to 120 pounds. Interestingly enough, there's more that you can know in there. So I'm just going to use what people usually give as the best guess. Most people guess between 25 and 45 pounds as the best guess. So let's say that they guess 35 pounds. I'll just stick it right in the middle. Okay. So most people give a lower bound similar to yours. It's usually 10 or 15 at the lower end. And at the upper end, they usually say 100 to 130. Okay. So you were like that lower bound and upper bound that you had was right in there. But then they usually say 35 pounds as their best guess. And when I say to them, well, why'd you guess 35 pounds as your best guess? That seems to be a lot closer to 15. Than 120, they'll say, oh, well, because mostly dogs are small on the smaller side. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So not only did you give me this actually pretty narrow range of what my dog could weigh, but you told me what the shape of the distribution of dogs in general is, that it skews to the smaller side. And they're like, oh. And I'm like, so you said, I don't know, but it turns out you know a lot. And I think there's just like such an important lesson in that to understand that we don't want to just like throw our hands up. What we want to say is, okay, let me really try to figure out what do I know? What don't I know? Get some sort of like boundary, some confidence interval around that. And then that makes it a lot easier for us to start making decisions because every decision that we make is a forecast of the future. Every single one. So if that's going to be the case, then we have to try to get sort of better, sort of not better, but what I would say is more realistic vision of the future. And that means that when things feel very certain, we probably need to set our confidence intervals wider. And when things feel very uncertain, we need to not throw our hands up and say, I don't know, it's too hard right now. And instead just set a confidence interval that reflects the fact that there's more uncertainty. That's going to help your forecast, which is then going to help you make much better decisions. And that's where the opportunity is, right? Because you can be like a poker player and say, if I'm willing to embrace the uncertainty and actually think about what the possible worlds are that can unfold, and actually try to think pretty clearly about what the probability of those words unfolding, you know, lower bound, upper bound, make sure that I've got my confidence intervals kind of in order, then my ability to navigate the possible futures is going to be better. And there's opportunity in that.
I love all of this. And I want to break this down even deeper. But before we do that, you've piqued my curiosity.
Oh, no.
What kind of a dog do you have?
Oh, okay. So this
Specific reason I chose 85 pounds. But let's go deeper into this because now you've piqued my curiosity.
Okay. So I'm going to answer that in a second. But I love that you asked that question because when you actually approach the world in this way and you say, instead of trying to figure out what the exact answer is if it's 2 + 2 = 4, which is almost nothing is, and instead say, here's my best guess. Here's the lower bound. Here's the upper bound. You can do this with like, calling Q3 sales, like, you know, how long is a project going to take? Like so and so forth. You can do it with anything. When you approach the world that way, implied in that is a question or two or three or four, which is, okay, I don't really know anything about your dog. I just know it's a dog. And so here it is. But there, oh, you know, if I'm not trying to do a best guess and I'm actually trying to get a good range on this, it would be helpful if I knew what kind of dog. So it actually starts to get your curiosity going, where remember that one of the problems that we have in making decisions is that we have very limited information. We know very little in comparison to all there is to be known. And the sad thing is, a lot of times when we're approaching these types of estimates or decisions, we don't actually go seek out the information. But when you actually start to think about the world in this way, it's like, okay, I have to sort of properly represent what I know and what I don't know. It will start to get you to ask questions, which then increases your knowledge. One of the questions you might ask is, what is the breed of your dog? And the breed of my dog is a mini Bernedoodle.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay. So a Bernedoodle is a Bernese Mountain Dog, very large, bred with a standard poodle. Very large, right? So Bernedoodles tend to run between about 80 and 110 pounds. I would say maybe 70 and 110 pounds.
So I was pretty close then.
If it was a Bernedoodle. But it's a mini Bernedoodle. And a mini Bernedoodle is a Bernese Mountain Dog. So I want you to imagine it's a female Bernese Mountain Dog, which is going to be like 80, 90 pounds, bred with a toy poodle. So Otis, my dog, His mom was 80 pounds and his dad was 13 pounds and looked like Martin Scorsese.
I don't even want to picture what that process looked like.
It's so cute. Anyway, so my dog weighs 40 pounds. Actually, my dog, who I just took on a hike, is right. wait, let me try to find him.
Uh-oh, we lost the dog.
There he is.
Oh, yeah.
He's having a little rest.
Well, if we're going to really get deep into the psychology of it, and again, for anybody that's here, like, what the hell does this have to do with me navigating a creative career in crisis? We'll get there in a second. But this was the heuristic that went through my mind. As soon as you said how much you think my dog weighs, what I thought was, what kind of a dog person do I think Annie is? That was the framework I was using. It wasn't, let me regress to the mean or what do I think the average is. It was, I was trying to read, what kind of a dog do I think you would want? Are you a tiny dog person? Are you a big dog person? And in my mind, I was thinking, she talks about hiking. She likes going outside. She probably doesn't have a toy dog. My thought was, she's probably a golden retriever type dog person. That's where I got the 85 pounds. That was the process that I went through.
Golden retrievers weigh 85 pounds? I don't know.
Yeah, they're about that big.
Okay.
I mean, it depends. Obviously, it depends. But in general, a golden retriever is anywhere between 80 and 100 pounds.
So this is actually a great thing that you just said. I love this. You always like say these things where I'm like, and let me dig in on that. Okay. So we have a tendency to over-index on things that we think we know. Okay. So in this case, you decided that you knew that I was a big dog person.
I thought perhaps I didn't know that. I'm like, I was making some really
well,
very
if you guessed
85
pounds, you think definitely I'm a big dog person. I'm definitely not a little dog person. You were right. But so here's actually how we want to approach these types of things. And I think that this actually can be very helpful in the times that we're living in right now, which is this. What is the answer if I think about a situation similar to the one that I'm considering? Okay. So this is going to get you to what's called a base rate or like the average that something occurs. Okay. So let's imagine that I'm Zach Arnold and I'm trying to guess the weight of Annie Duke's dog. I would quickly go over to Google and I would say, what's the average weight of a dog? And I would go find out what that is. And then I would say, okay, let me start there. And do I think that on average, Annie Duke's dog, given what I know about her, is going to be more or less than this average dog? But you should never go too far away unless there's a huge dislocation. Now, obviously, if you know that I have a Great Dane, you can now take the average size of a Great Dane, and that can be your guess. But given that it's just all dogs, you would have to do that. So actually, we could just Google it, right? What's the average weight of a dog? Well, medium dog, it's giving me the middle. It doesn't like giving me the average. That's interesting.
Well, it's also a challenge too, because you can ask, well, is it the average if you take one individual of all of the breeds versus the dogs that actually exist, and you can over-index on most people have small dogs versus large dogs? Like, this is the kind of question that could break ChatGPT's brain.
Right. So ChatGPT is very unhappy with this question.
I was just going to say,
you have to tell me what kind of dog.
Exactly. Yep.
Anyway, it said the middle range is 20 to 60 pounds. So you could take the center point of that.
Sure.
Which would be 40.
Yeah. I was going to say the number I would have chosen was 40.
Right. So I have to make ChatGPT is annoying about it because they're like, what kind of dog is it? And I'm like, you don't know, ChatGPT.
That's the whole point.
That's the whole point. Anyway, so it would say 40. So now you would start at 40 as your best guess. And then you would say, do I think that Annie's dog is going to be smaller than the average or bigger than the average? And then you can say, well, she said she just went hiking with her dog. So it only gives me smaller than average. I think it's going to be bigger than average. But because I don't really know, I shouldn't stray too far. All right. So when should you stray really far? Well, again, it depends, right? So you might, this is what's called a reference class. So in this case, the reference class is all dogs. But if you know I had a Great Dane, your reference class would become Great Danes. Okay, so that would be a shift that might occur. But this actually becomes relevant to what's happening today, is any base rate or like average that you're looking at is going to have some sort of cause of that average. So let me get to this. Okay. So let's imagine that I was trying to predict the chances that I develop lung cancer in my lifetime. If I go and look at stats for, you know, what was the probability that a female, develops lung cancer in their lifetime from the 1960s, I'm going to have a base rate. But if I think about, well, what are the causal drivers of lung cancer? I'm going to be like, oh, smoking. Smoking is a big causal driver of lung cancer. A lot of people smoked in the 1960s. So I should actually just sort of almost throw that out. Because there's been this what we mean by a dislocation, right? Is that the causal mechanisms of the thing are just broken now. And when you see that the causal mechanisms are broken, what you would then say is, like, in a way that would make it much less likely or much more likely. So in the case of the chances that I'm going to develop lung cancer, it's not just that I don't smoke, it's that people around me don't smoke, right? So that's got to really, really reduce it. That could cause me to go find a better reference class because I could look at more recent data. But if I don't have it, I can go work with that and then really drastically reduce. Likewise, we could think about how it might increase. So if I wanted to know what the probability that a Category 3 high or hurricane makes landfall in the U.S. this fall, I don't really want to use data from 25 years ago. The ocean was cooler. But if that's the only data that I have, then I have to say, wait, the ocean is warmed up, and I should guess pretty far away from the base rate then, right? So I should really like notch it up a lot. But if I'm looking at data from the last 5 years, I should just guess that. I should guess, well, what's the probability been over the last 5 years when the ocean was about the same temperature, and just guess that. And this is something that actually becomes really helpful in these times, right? Because then you can start to think about, what's going to happen to my job? What has job retention been? If somebody, leaves their job, how long does it take for somebody to get a new job? How has that been historically in my field? What are the dislocations? Obviously, AI is a very, very big dislocation right now. What does that mean for how long it might take me to go find something else? And then you can start to think about, how long does it take to retrain if I want to actually go into a different field? As I think about that dislocation and that causal driver and what that's going to affect, what might it affect less? Could I go do those things, right? So you now start to do what's called explore alternatives, try to understand how it might affect things like length of job search, as an example. How long you might stay in a particular job. so on and so forth. So once you start to think about those causal drivers, it actually opens up a world for you to start to figure out, like, what do I think the future is really going to look like here? And then B, start to create a really good plan in order to deal with that.
There is about a million different directions that we could go. So many great cognitive frameworks, high level ideas. I want to bring it down to something really, really practical. And then I have a little bit of a side idea that you can decide that you want to run with or not run with. Maybe it's another Pandora's box. Now, it sounds like we're by and large talking about how do I make decisions going forwards? How do I handle this uncertainty? But I think, and like, what paths do I explore? What other avenues? But I think one of the biggest questions on everybody's mind comes back to the fundamental question, do I stick it out or do I quit? And let me frame this a little bit more for you for this industry specifically. When we were talking 3-4 years ago, it was about the great resignation. I'm realizing this is not the path for me. Things have obviously changed and flipped 180 degrees. But there are so many people in my industry, in my community, where it's, should I still stick it out or do I give up on all of my skills, on all of my expertise, on years of this career path, and do I quote unquote start over? I had this start over conversation extensively with Christina Wallace for anybody that wants to go back and listen to that. But right now, I think the big question of should I stick it or should I quit? It's not just how do I, figure out the expected value equation for this one job? It's for an entire career path and even deeper, an entire identity. That's the should I stick with it or should I quit question for people. So I want to frame all the things you were talking about around that, because I think that's where so many people are stuck. The side idea that you can completely ignore, or we can go down this rabbit hole separately. You're talking about, let's talk about the things that we know, the things that we don't know. You realize a whole lot more than you think you do. There's this giant black chasm of things that we don't know that we don't know. But let's start with, how do we fundamentally use your frameworks to ask, do I stick with this career path and this identity, or do I quit and quote unquote start over?
Okay. Your career is not your identity. And, in the best of times, when people are in a career that they really don't like, why don't they leave? Okay, so everybody in the audience can think about this, right? Like, there's no doubt that you have had some situation in your past where you were in a relationship that wasn't making you happy and you didn't leave. You were in a job that wasn't making you happy and you didn't leave. You had chosen a career, whether it's out of college or whatever, that it turned out wasn't for you, but you didn't leave. You picked a major in college. Turned out it wasn't really what you wanted, but you didn't switch. Right? This is happening to us all the time. There's all sorts of reasons that that occurs. One of them, which you mentioned, is the sunk cost fallacy, which is, I've put so much time and energy and training and blah, blah, blah into this thing. If I leave, what does that, I've wasted all of that time. And of course you haven't wasted all of that time, right? I mean, it got you to wherever you were, it got you to the place that you are. To the realizations and the knowledge and, all that stuff that you have today. But if what you've already put into something caused you to stick to something that is not allowing you to achieve your goal, let's say your broad goal is happiness. Just broadly an umbrella for everything, whatever happiness is defined for you. But if you're staying in something that isn't actually the right thing because you found out after the fact that you didn't like it, or you used to like it and then you changed, or the world changed and you don't like it anymore, and you stay in it because you feel like you'll have wasted everything that you already put into it, then you're wasting everything you're putting from that moment on forward, because you're continuing to do something that isn't actually helping you to achieve your goals. Not only that, so that's bad, but not only that, it's not allowing you to change, to put all that effort into something new that might be great for you, that might really open up the world for you. So you get a double hit, right? So people have the idea that walking away from things actually stops your progress. It stops you in your tracks, and it's not true. It's actually a way to speed up. Because if I'm doing something that isn't actually allowing me to achieve my goals, partly because I think I'll have wasted everything I put into it, I'm not only is that causing me to lose ground, but I can't switch to something that will cause me to gain ground. That's a twofold problem. It's double hit. Okay. The other thing besides sunk cost that tends to really get us stuck in things is this identity piece. And let's just not talk about identity as like, I'm a product manager, right? Like, let's not take it that way. But like, let's think about identity as this combination of what we call internal and external validity. Internal validity is how do you view yourself in terms of your own narrative, right? Do you view that narrative positively? Do I think that I'm a good decision maker? I'm consistent over time. I have good character, you know, like this story that we tell about our lives. And one of the things in that internal validity piece is that when we quit things, it's a challenge to that, because then there's this moment of, wait, but did I choose badly in the first place? What does this mean in terms of the way that I think about myself, that I'm not consistent in my choices? That's the internal piece, the way that we're sort of telling the story about ourselves. But then there's something called external validity, is the way we imagine other people will view us. And we tell all sorts of stories about that, right? They're going to think that I'm a wimp, or I don't have enough grit, or I couldn't stick it out, or, you know, all those things that go along with that, that cause you to not walk away. And it's interesting, because I think that all of us can think about people who have left jobs or have left relationships that weren't working for them, or did change majors, or had a, you know, career change when they were 40 or 45 or whatever. And I don't think any of us think like, oh, what a wimp. They couldn't stick it out. No, we're all like, oh, that was really courageous. They totally changed their lives, and we're all pretty happy. But it's not the story that we're telling, right? So those are kind of the two sides of identity, the internal piece and then the way we imagine people might view us. And that's the sticking point, is that we believe that people will view us negatively, mainly because we're going to view ourselves negatively in those situations, right? So what happens that's kind of interesting is that in situations where we're not forced to walk away from something, where it's either a choice, you know, we sort of feel like we're still in a choice mode, we don't walk away until we don't have a choice. We stay in the startup until there's no money, instead of returning capital to the investors, for example, right? I was talking to someone the other day and I said, has there ever been a time when you thought, ooh, you know, I really quit that too soon? Or is it mostly like you look back and you're like, oh, I wish I'd done that sooner? And the person said to me, this was so funny, they said, no, actually, I just quit something that I think was right on time. And I was like, really? So tell me about that. Because I was very curious, because you usually don't hear that. That was a rare thing to hear. And they said, yeah, I was thinking back in September that I was really unhappy. So I spent 6 months trying everything and exhausting all of my options. And so then after I had exhausted all of my options, I quit. And so I know I feel good about the quit. And I was like, if you exhausted all your options, that means you had no choice but to quit. And I went through some exercises with them. I was like, what if in September you had said to yourself, like, what are the circumstances under which you would stay in this job? What would they have been? And he listed them off. And I was like, when did you see those signals? And he was like, September. And I was like, so you're telling me you stuck around 6 months longer? And that was for the identity piece, for what you're talking about. I want to be able to tell people that I exhausted all my options so that I don't have a negative view of myself and they don't have a negative view of me. So that's when you have choice, right? So what I would say to people right now is start preparing. You're in a job, you don't know what the technology is going to look like. You don't know what that's going to mean. First of all, try to take some of these guesses, right? Look, what do I think the worst case scenario is? The lowest that my dog could weigh? What do I think the best case scenario is? The upper bound of what my dog could weigh? But try to figure out what those things are, right? Like, what are the different worlds look like that might occur for what I'm doing? Try to take some guess of what you think the chances of those things occurring are. And then, just as I had to do at the poker table, start planning across that range. So how would you do that, right? You would start thinking about, should I be saving money? and make sure that I have money in the bank, because I could be forced out and then have some period of time where I either have to go get, you know, trained for something new or go find a new job. And that's probably going to be longer than usual right now. So how do you start to prepare yourself for that, right? You might start thinking about how do I start training myself for a different career while you're still doing the job that you're in, right? So you can start to think about, like, as I think about these different ways that the world could go, and I'm trying to really embrace, like, not saying I know it's going to go this way, but here, I really want to understand the different ways that this might go. I want to talk to some other people, get their input to help me get a clearer view of that. How do I then start to plan for the different ways that that could go? And that would be like where I would definitely be starting.
I think that's a great place to start. For my audience, that was a great conversation to have 2 years ago. So now the question becomes, you're no longer in the place where you can plan, you still have the opportunity. Now it's time to hunker down. It's time to save. Maybe it's time to learn new skills. Fast forward in this timeline, 2, 3, 5 years, the savings has run out. You've spent 2 years trying to figure out, are there any opportunities left? Are my skills even relevant anymore? Now I feel like the decision-making changes.
Well, that's why I'm saying that part of what's going to be in that set is my skills are no longer relevant, right? So at that point, you have to think about, how do I make my skills relevant? You may need to learn new skills. Like, you have to actually like plan for all of those different occurrences, right? So, you know, some of that has to do with trying to predict, what are the things that I could be doing or I could be trying that are actually going to be durable in the environment that we're in, and understand it might change, but what's my best guess over the next 3 to 5 years of skills that are going to be in demand and durable? And start to think about that. And as you think about, what are those different skills? What are the things that I'd like to try? And I really recommend that while you have the job that you have, you start skill, you know, upskilling in other things. And this is called a hedge, right? So that it is going to cost you something, right? It's going to take time. It might take your evenings. It might take, you know, sucking up to someone in another department or whatever, but it's going to help you to actually expand your options that are available to you. And that's one of the things that you always want to be thinking about when you're making choices about what you're investing your time in, is how do I actually expand the options that I have? And right now is the time to start really thinking deeply about how to expand your options. And again, that's where the opportunity is, right? If you're thinking about that sooner than other people are, you're going to be better prepared for the disruption, and you're going to be much more likely to land on your feet. There's a funny stat. I hope it's true. I wouldn't bet my life on it, but I think it is, that if you major in philosophy in college, it opens the most doors for you. Like, the most career paths are open for you. If you major in philosophy, if you get a PhD in philosophy, the fewest careers open for you, which I think is pretty funny. But it's a way to think about that, right? Like, what are the skills that I can go acquire that actually work across the widest range of possibilities, so that I can expand the options that are going to be available to me, instead of just accepting that the world is right now narrowing my options? Because in some ways, the world is narrowing your options, but you can actually make decisions that will expand the number of options that you have.
And I want to get into that in a second. This idea of, well, where do we hedge our bets? What are the things that we focus on? I very much have an idea that I've been telling my students for years where I think they should over-index, where I am over-indexing. I want to put a pin in that just for a couple of minutes. I want to come back to one more thing, very specifically speaking about the identity piece and going much deeper into the emotional side rather than the logical, rational, probability side. And I actually want to pull a short quote from your book, which is, When you quit, you're closing a mental account. And we know that we don't like to close those accounts, especially when they're in the losses. If you abandon a belief, that is the moment that you admit you were mistaken. This next sentence, this is the one that hits home for me and for so many other people. If you set out on a course of action and you change your mind, that's when you go from failing to I have failed. They're two very different things. Like, I'm in the process of failing versus now I have not only failed, I am a failure. So let's go a little bit deeper into the emotional reasons that we are hanging on to this identity, this job title, these skills that we desperately are clinging to. We hope they're relevant. I don't want to learn new skills. Let's go a little bit deeper into the emotional piece before we talk about how we hedge our bets.
Yeah. Okay. So when I'm talking about like internal and external validity, I think in the way that you're using emotion, it would go under that category, right? This is, you know, how am I sort of telling the narrative of myself? What are my feelings about myself? How do I view myself? How do I think other people are going to view me? How are they going to feel about me? How is that going to feel for me? So I want to say that so I think that I followed that point with saying, okay, yes, you go from failing to having failed, but it's only on one account and it's not really true. So we think about closing a mental account, and all that means is like, if I start a job, I open up a mental account for that job. It's like a ledger. It's like a, you know, a column in your ledger. If I buy a stock, I open up an account for that stock. If I start a relationship, I open up an account for that relationship. If I start running a marathon, I open up an account for that marathon. And so we can think about, like, as a marathon runner, if I stop the race before 26.2 miles, I have failed. If I sell a stock less than I bought it for, I'm closing that account in the losses, and I feel like a failure. I feel like I failed. We can see that that's kind of absurd, though, because, like, if somebody runs 13.2 miles in the context of a half marathon, they're quite successful. And actually, what's really interesting is I don't know anybody who's ever run beyond 13. I guess it's 13.1 miles. I don't think I've ever known anyone who, in the context of a half marathon, have run more than 13.1 miles. Like, these marks, that the benchmarks that we have, are really arbitrary, right? But if you run 13.1 miles in the context of a marathon, you failed. And likewise, in a marathon, I don't know anyone who ever ran more than 26.2 miles in a marathon, right? Like, these demarcations, like, these benchmarks that we have, are like so incredibly arbitrary, number one. And number two, we forget that the sum total of, like, we forget that how our life turns out is actually kind of like the sum of all the decisions we make, not just one, not just one stock we buy, right? It's all the equities that we have. Like, anybody who indexes, that's what you're doing. You're just buying a lot of stocks. Some of them are going to lose, some of them are going to win. On average, you should do pretty well. It's not how you do in one marathon. It's how you do across all the races that you want run. It's not how you do in one relationship. It's like, how are you doing across the board? Like, this is true, whether it's friends or whatever. We don't. And then the other thing is that it's not even within category. It's like, how my life turns out is like, how did I do in the marathon? Plus, how did I do in buying stocks? Plus, how did I do in picking a job? Plus, how did I do in picking a life partner, or picking my friends, or picking who my dog was going to be, or whatever it might be. It's all just the portfolio of your decisions, but we don't think about it that way. Okay. So that's how we get to suddenly the one failure feels so freaking bad to us, because we're not at that moment thinking about it in the context of all the decisions that we've actually made. Right. And I would argue that the actual failure is to stick to something that isn't working for you. Because again, when you do that, you're not gaining ground toward the things that you're actually trying to achieve, and you can't switch to things that will. So that's an actual failure. Okay, so that's part of the problem. So when we get to the emotional piece, there's this quote from Danny Kahneman that I actually just love and say all the time. Nothing is as important as it feels when you're thinking about it. So what does that mean? It means that when we're thinking about something, like we're in that moment of thinking about, should we let this employee go? Or should we quit our job? Or should I stop this marathon? Or should I keep going? Or you're having an argument with your spouse. It doesn't matter what it is. It feels so outsized, and it's important in the context of everything that's going to happen over your life. And that is when you are going to be super, super, super irrational and emotional about the decision that you're making. So how do we solve for that? We have to stop being in the moment in that decision. I know people are always like, be in the moment. And it's like, yes, sometimes that's good if you're, you know, really anxious or something, but sometimes it's good to get out of the moment. And when you get out of the moment, what you do is you say, imagine it's a year from now. And so it's a really good tool. It's called mental time travel. It gets you out of the moment. So I'm holding on to a stock. I don't want to sell it because even though I've lost $10, I want to get my money back. That's the, that's sunk cost. And then everybody will think I'm an idiot because I bought a stock that lost. That's identity, right? And so then I hold on to it. But what if you stopped and said, imagine it's a month from now and I'm still holding this stock. How do I think I'm going to feel about that? Am I going to look back on that and say, yay me, like I held on to that stock, I'm so smart? How do I think it's going to turn out? What do I think the probability is that things are going to go well or things are going to go poorly? I can take it even further and I could say, let's imagine that the stock continues to go down. Why do I think that is? What do I think the chances of those reasons being true are? What do I think the early signals are that those things are true? That I'm probably going to ignore? Am I ignoring them right now? And this just stops you from being in the moment and gets you into this mental space where you're sort of in the future, like looking back. And it allows you to get just a much clearer vision of kind of what the right thing to do is, right? So when you're like in the middle of that marathon and, you know, you're having some sort of horrible knee pain and you don't want to quit because you think that you're going to be a failure, say, okay, it's, you know, a week from now and I kept running this race. Am I going to be happy that I made that decision? Imagine it turns out as badly as possible. Like, why do I think that is? Given how I'm feeling now, like, what do I think the chances are that that's true? If I look back and say, whoa, like I tore my ACL, what were the early signals that that was going to happen? What were they? Am I experiencing them right now? Like, you're probably going to stop running, or you're going to be more likely to if you do that. So this is like a really good tool for handling that emotional piece and helping us to stop thinking about each individual decision as if it's the only decision we've ever made or ever will make, because that's where a lot of mistakes are coming in.
It's so funny you brought this up. I didn't think that I was going to make this connection, but in one of the interviews that I did for day 5 of the summit, and for those that are following along, it's going to be with Kalika Sharma. I did this exercise at the very end of our conversation. It was a little bit less an expert interview and more, she and I are both in the messy middle of midlife, figuring out how to navigate these transitions personally, professionally, the sandwich generation and otherwise. And I went through this exercise where I said, imagine that you from 5 years comes back to where you are now. What are the things that she's going to tell you? And that brings up, and this is going to be a little bit of shameless self-promotion, you highly, highly encourage people to have somebody in your life that you consider a quitting coach.
Yeah. Yeah. So look, when you're doing any of these exercises and you're saying, imagine it's a year from now and, right? So like for people who are really challenged with what's happening on the technological landscape, maybe they're challenged by like what's happening in the tariff landscape, like the economy, what does that mean? If you're in startups, like what is the funding environment going to look like? Like these things are all like super hard to figure out and deal with, right? Imagine it's a year from now is a really important thing. And how do we get to better views of imagine it's a year from now, right? Well, one of the things that we can do is go look for those things like base rates, right? So you can say, let me look kind of like, let's imagine that you're in venture and meaning you're on the startup side of venture and you're kind of looking at kind of what's happened with companies during these time periods. And you can look and say, in times of more uncertainty, you know, what was the ROI for the actual funders? Because that tells you what the ROI is for the companies themselves, right? So if you look at like funds that were investing like 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, and you compare them to funds that were investing in times that feel more certain, right? Which did better, right? So you can go look at that and that can help you to sort of understand like, is there actually opportunity here? Could this actually be a really good thing, right? So that's one thing that you could do. You could go ask people who have gone through dislocations and say, can you help me with this exercise? So one of the things I love to do is to say, okay, imagine it's a year from now and things have turned out great for me. Why do I think that is? And actually figure out like, what are those scenarios under which the world has gone really well? Why do I think that the world has gone that well for me? That's called a backcast. Then do the pre-mortem. Imagine things have gone really poorly. What are the different worlds that are going badly for me? Why do I think that those have occurred? Write down what do I think the early signals are that I'm going to end up on some of these good paths? What do I think the early signals are that I'm going to end up on some of these bad paths that I would probably ignore? Because we know that because we're identity protective. And if I see those signals, what would I do about it, right? So we want to say, if I see those signals, what would I do about it? Do that exercise on your own. Go get other people to do it for you. Don't give them your answers. And it's really great if they're like mentors, they're people who've gone through this before. Like if you're, let's say that you're in a startup, like let's imagine you were a founder of a startup, get your investors to do that for you. Don't tell them what your answers are, right? If you're in product, for example, go find some people who you really trust, who have experience, who've lived through a lot of stuff to go and do that for you. Find someone who's an expert in AI to go do it for you. Like go figure out like, how do I find other viewpoints, right? That are going to help me to understand what this world really looks like. That's going to help you to actually sort of set out, what are those scenarios? Why do I think they could have occurred? What are the signals that I might see that would tell me that's going to happen? What am I going to do if I see those things, right? Then having done that, find someone to hold you to it, right? They should be someone who's probably done the exercise for you themselves. Then you help, you work with them to combine, sort of integrate all the information, which ironically you can do using Claude or ChatGPT. And you figure out sort of across everybody, what are the differences? What are the unique answers? What are the things that people are really agreeing on? What are the signals that they're saying I'm going to see? And sit down with someone who you really trust and say, okay, I want to end up in this better version of the world. Here are the signals that I should not ignore, that things aren't going well. I'm committing to you that this is what I'm going to do if I see those things. Sometimes it's going to be walking away. And I'm going to check in with you and make sure that you're actually holding me accountable to this, and just create an accountability coach as far as, you know, really actually being reacting to what the world is telling you a lot better and following through on the plans that you're making to actually try to deal with those different scenarios so that you can actually hedge your bets better.
Given all that, if you'll behoove me, this is actually something you did in our previous conversation. You may or may not know, you actually ended up becoming my quitting coach for debating whether or not, because of a major shoulder injury, do I want to continue towards gritting through American Ninja Warrior, right, or do I want to quit? And at the time, I chose to pause and not quit. Like you said, you really never quit a decision. I think you had said the only decision that you actually quit and fail is when you're dead. Other than that, for the most part, you can revisit them. So this is one that I had to put on pause. All the things that had happened in my life between our conversation and now, a world of things that I won't get into in this conversation. But what I want to do is I want to do another one of these very, very brief sessions just to give people a sense of how this can apply. Talking about this idea of sunk cost fallacy, specifically with the work that we're doing right here. We're going to get very meta. We're going to get meta about choosing to rebrand my company, rebrand my podcast, launching a summit like this. I have a saying that I only half jokingly tell my students whenever things get really, really hard for me, my saying is always, I'm going to quit tomorrow. So when it comes to building this business, I've been saying I'm going to quit tomorrow for about 7 or 8 years. I just got to get through today. I got to make it to the next tree, but I'll quit tomorrow. But things have gotten very, very real over the course of the last 6 months. All the things that are happening in the industry, enrollment is going down, income is getting lower, seeing the prospects on the horizon are more challenging. And I decided, you know what? I could just close things down. I could go back and try and find something that I did before to pay the bills. But I said, I'm going to go all in on this. And what I want to better understand, you can help me break this down. How can I have the confidence that I'm making the right decision to go all in on this, despite how challenging and how hard it is?
Okay, can I just say something?
Please.
I hate that I'm going to quit tomorrow.
Tell me why. Please challenge me.
Because there's always a tomorrow. And so, look, people put so much value on grit that what happens is, you know, the question is, how do you end up running into people who are like, I want to talk to you about whether I should quit my job. And I'm like, okay, tell me about it. And they're like, I've hated it for 5 years. Like, legit. And of course, like, to an outside observer, you're like, wait, you've hated your job for 5 years. Like, why are you still in it? Like, in your head, you're thinking this. And it's always because I'm going to quit tomorrow. Because we put so much value on sticking to things that when we say, well, I can always do that tomorrow, then that the next day we say, I can always do that tomorrow. And all of a sudden you're 5 years in and you're still in a job that you hate. Even though when I would say to the person, like, okay, imagine it's a year from now. What do you think the chances are you're going to be happy in this role? They're like, zero. I've been unhappy for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, what are the chances you're going to be happy after you quit? And they're like, well, I'm not sure because there's uncertainty and I don't know. And I'm like, okay, but like, give me a guess. And they'll usually say like 50%. And I'll be like, okay, is 50% greater than zero? So I always want to get to that person before the 5 years has passed. So here's the wonderful thing about really thinking about this, like, quit decision is it's actually a sticker quit decision that you're thinking about. Mm-hmm. So this is what I would suggest that you do. Given how things are right now, I would ask myself, how long am I okay with things being the way that they are? So I'll ask you that. Given what you just told me, how long are you okay with things being the way they are?
If we take the bank account of the numbers out of it, I love everything that I'm doing. I would do exactly where I am right now. I would do this the rest of my career. When we bring the bank account into it, there are numbers that's, of course. So there is going to be a point that comes relatively soon that if the summit doesn't do what I need it to do, re-enrollment for the next semester, et cetera, you know, all these various variables.
So just give me a date.
It would be before the
end. How long are you okay with things the way they are?
It would definitely be before the end of the year. We're counting it in months, not years.
Fantastic. Okay, so like, are we saying December 31st? Are we saying?
I would say that it's nebulous, but it's somewhere in the middle between where we are now and the end of the year. So a few months.
Okay, so let's call it September 15th.
Sure.
Great. Okay. Fantastic. So that's the start. That's where we're going to start. So you're okay with things the way they are until September 15th. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Imagine it's September 15th and you have decided that you should continue with the podcast, that things are great and this is a thing that absolutely you should be going all in on. You don't need to necessarily do this here, but if you want to, that's fine.
Please, let's do it.
What's happened? It's September 15th. It's a few months from now. What's happened?
I mean, like, as far as if I'm predicting if things are going the best that they would, that's what you're asking,
like,
right?
What's happened? What are the things that are occurring? Like, what's happened?
The, you know, podcast audience's growth. I've found a new audience in broader creative fields. Enrollment has gone up in the next semester of our academy. I built a new relationship. So I'm in the process of building a public speaking career. I mean, I could go on and on about the best case scenario.
I'm going to ask you to do this one offline, but what I want you to do is actually write down, what would enrollment have to be? Actually, write that down. You can give me a lower bound for that. That's okay. Like, this would be the lowest it could be. Maybe not. Like, what's the lowest enrollment that you could see, thinking about, like, okay, it's September 15th and I'm looking back, right? the lowest enrollment that you got, that would tell you that you it's still worth pursuing, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with like speaking career, like what's happened? Am I seeing bookings? Am I, so actually be specific and write those things down. Okay. Cause you sort of gave some broad things, but I want you to be pretty specific mm-hmm. about those things. Great. So now that creates some benchmarks. And so what I know is that if I were to talk to September 15th, Zach, and say, you're like, oh, you know, looking back that, you know, things didn't go that well, that it's going to be anything that falls below those benchmarks that we just set, right? So if you're above the benchmarks, you're good. If you're below the benchmarks, you're not. Fair?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Great. Now, I want you to now tell me, in order to achieve that good version of the world, to get the speaking bookings that you want, to have the summit be the success that you want, to have enrollment go up, you know, to a level that you think is going to be sustainable for you, what are the inputs? What are the things that you have to do? Now, you could write down what things have to go right, but like some of those things might be out of your control. So I just want to know for you, what are the things that you need to do in order to create that good version of the world?
Like specific to-do lists? Is that the kind of the answer you're looking
for? Yeah. So like, let's imagine it this way. So let's imagine that let's talk about our friend who exhausted all options. Mm-hmm. And I wish that they hadn't because that was too long. But they were, you know, just because they were unhappy that day didn't mean they ought to quit that day. I actually asked him, what would your quit? This was in September. Like, how long would you have been okay with that continuing to be that way? And they actually said December 31st, which would have been 3 months before they actually left, which would have been great. And I said, what I said was, okay, what did you need to see happen? And they were like, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what were the inputs to that? And they were like, well, I needed to go find a marketing mentor and I need to go find this and I need to go find that. So they actually started thinking about what would be the inputs to creating the good version of the world, right? Now, they happened to exhaust all of them until there was no, you know, hope, which I don't want you to do. But so that's what I'm talking about. Like, what are the things that you could do in order to create that better version of the world, to increase the probability that it was going to occur?
And I would say this is very meta. It's literally what we're doing right now. It's having conversations with people like you, collecting and coalescing those conversations so people that desperately need them know how they can take action. They can make sense of the world that makes no sense right now. They learn from all these strategies and they say, hey, I'm looking for a quote unquote quitting coach or a career coach or somebody that can help me navigate this next stage. So what we're doing right now is me going all in on the inputs that are going to lead to what I hope to be the output in September.
And then I would challenge you to sit down and say, what are the other things I could do besides that? Right. So you're doing this, but like, what are the things you could do in terms of like networking, getting to like, could you go find a speaking agent? Could you talk to somebody? You know, I can give you a suggestion. If you know some good speakers, they often have to refuse a lot of bookings. Mm-hmm. Go talk to as many of them as you can and ask them to refer you when they can't take a job. That's a free one for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a strategy that I share with my students all the time as well.
Yeah, exactly. So now we've got that. So you're going to say, okay, and then you're going to commit to doing those things. And what you're going to do is you're going to say, if I fall below these benchmarks on September 15th, and I have done all of these things, then I must change. And the way that you could change is you could say, I need to downsize and go do something else for my main money in order to deal with my bank account. Like, I don't know what it is that you would choose to do, but that would tell you whether you're supposed to go all in or do something else. I am not against people doing things in parallel, by the way. I think it's great. You don't need to commit to one thing at a time. You can do things in parallel. But if your choice right now is, do I basically make this the only thing? Then, and you're telling me you need to have this figured out by September 15th, set those benchmarks, figure out what the inputs are to get above those benchmarks. And then if you get there, full steam ahead. But what I want you to do is on September 15th, after you've made the decision, so I'm just going to imagine that you exceed your benchmarks and you are going to continue to go all in. On September 15th, I want you to do this exercise again. Because you have to do it on repeat. And so maybe then it's, you know, December 31st or whatever. I don't know what that new date would be, but redo it. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would do is something called monkeys and pedestals.
Well, I'm so glad you got here. I was going to get here, but I didn't want to go down this road because we didn't have time. So I'm so glad you went here.
Okay, we're going to get here because I've got 6 minutes. So let's do it in 6 minutes. So monkeys and pedestals is from Astro Teller, who's over at X, which is the innovation hub for Google.
Now the other X, right?
The other X, right. The original X, I think.
Yeah.
But they're called Google X now, actually. They changed it back. But so he talks about this idea of monkeys and pedestals. And let's imagine you're trying to train a monkey to juggle flaming torches while standing on a pedestal in the town square. Where are you supposed to start? Should you start with the juggling monkey to figure out if they'll do that with the flaming torches? Or should you build the pedestal first? Interestingly enough, in that frame, when you sort of give it that frame, most people say the monkey first. But what's funny is in practice, in real life, most people do the pedestal first. And this is true for large public works projects, but it's also true for anybody who's ever been in a meeting where people say, what's the low-hanging fruit? And then they are like, let's go do that. Okay, it's not the monkey. The monkey is the thing that you don't know if you can accomplish. It's like the bottleneck. It's the thing that's going to unlock the system. So an example of a monkey would be, let's imagine that I want to build electric cars and it's in the 1990s. There's a monkey, which is, can I create a battery that's going to have a long enough life to actually create enough mileage, right, in between having to recharge to make this a practical thing for people to own? A pedestal would be designing the car. Because the battery is the problem, right? Like, can you put wheels on the thing? Can you make it aerodynamic? Can you make it pretty? Like all those things. But people will tinker around with that without actually solving this very big problem. What is the bottleneck to actually success? And in the monkey and pedestal example, it's, well, I don't know if a monkey will actually juggle flaming torches. Like, you know, Frankenstein won't do that. So I don't know if a monkey will do that. So I should probably figure that out before I decide to move forward. So that's the other thing that I would suggest that you do, is to say, what are the monkeys in all of this? Like, if I'm actually going to be successful and achieve this by the 15th, what are the monkeys? What are the things that are the real bottlenecks to success? And how can I actually attack those and figure out whether those are solvable as quickly as possible? And if you approach things that way, then you can get to answers much more quickly. And you're much more likely to walk away when you actually find out that you can't solve the hard thing first. And it helps with the sunk cost problem, because you put less effort into silly things like pedestal building that make it say, but I've put so much time and effort into something that even though I can't get the monkey to do this, I'll actually just have them play an accordion, which is not what you were intending to do in the first place. So what I don't want you to get into a situation of is that you haven't solved the monkey and you see a little bit of progress, but not enough. And you keep going because you rationalize it.
I think that's a great place for us to close our final loop, which was, how do we hedge these bets? And I'm going to leave you with my version, knowing that we probably don't have any time to go into it any deeper. But the way that I'm hedging it is, I'm focusing on what are the things that stay the same rather than what are all the things that are changing. What are the skills that are going to equip all of us going into this future? The things that never change. We need to be really good at building relationships with humans. We need to get really good at telling our own stories. We need to get really good at using the mental heuristics that you and I talked about so that we can make better decisions. None of that changes with AI and technology and shifting business models and streaming. So for me, I feel that the monkey that is juggling the flaming torches, are there skills that people are going to be willing to invest in when nobody knows what skills to invest in, when nobody has any money to invest in their skills? So what I'm doubling down on is, I think that the monkey that's juggling the torches is the skills that stay the same, not all the skills that are changing. That's what I'm hedging my bets on and over-indexing on right now.
So I totally love that. There are some things that are durable. And investing in those things that you know are going to be durable, that's actually a very good example of using base rates really well, right? Like, just understanding, like, if I look over time at all of these dislocations, what are the things that have stayed the same over that time? And let me actually really invest in those things, right? I think that that's super smart. Another example of how to hedge would be if we take Blockbuster, which we mentioned before, selling actual physical cassette tapes, and then at some point DVDs, in a physical store that you went to go rent whatever movie that you wanted to see. The way for them to hedge would have been to acquire Netflix, which, by the way, they had the opportunity to do, and say, look, I'm not exactly sure where the future is going to go, but we've got enough capital to buy this company. And it may work out, it may not, it's going to cost us something. But just in case the streaming thing becomes big, which, if I say it's 10 years from now, we're out of business, why do I think that happened? An obvious answer is, well, we sell physical DVDs and the streaming thing happened to be really big. But obviously, it's probabilistic whether that's going to end up being big. But what this does is it hedges me, right? So if it becomes big, I own Netflix, yay me. If it doesn't become big, whatever. It didn't actually cost me that much in comparison to this humongous business that I have that has to do with like renting DVDs, right? Now, why didn't they do it? For the identity reason. Because they're Blockbuster. They have physical stores that sell, you know, that rent out VHS tapes or DVDs. They're not a streaming company. And wouldn't that disrupt themselves? Well, I don't know. Like, aren't they the same if they don't, right? Like, but they're going to disrupt sort of what their core identity is. And you saw this happen with Sears, who had a financial services company, and they unloaded all of that to protect their retail. So what you, Zach Arnold, you know, ought to be thinking about is not just like, what are the durable skills? What stays the same? But if I think about what might be different, can I skill up in that thing too? Right. And it will, if it doesn't work out, it costs you the time, but it might actually end up being something that saves you. Right. So those are the two different things that you can think about, right? Is like, how do I really invest in the things that stay the same? And that might take some time, and that's okay, which is why it's a hedge, right? And you should go do that. But then also think about like, how do I think that things might be different? What are the things that I could do? Because I want to acquire Netflix. Even if it might not work out, that's okay.
Well, I think I can speak for everybody that is attending right now that my brain hurts in all of the best ways possible. This is such a wonderful conversation.
I don't know if it's in a good way.
I'm saying that very much as a compliment, because you're really, really making me think and also rethink a lot of things, which I think everybody needs to be in a position to be willing to do right now. I really wish I could just keep pulling these threads, but I want to be very conscious of your time. So I just wanted to thank you for you being here again. I want to make sure that people are aware of both how they can find you, but also this other initiative that you're working on about the Alliance of Decision Education, because you're very, very passionate about this. Well, I'll leave you with the self-promotion portion of the program, and then I'll let you go because I know you got to run.
All right. You can just find me on annieduke.com. I also have a Substack called Thinking and Bets. Go find me there. The Alliance for Decision Education, we really believe, and actually I think in the world that we're living in, this is more true than ever, that the most important thing you can teach children is how to make better decisions. And we don't do that. We teach them trigonometry and we teach them calculus and all sorts of stuff that are just going to seem weird at some point that we ever were. I mean, it's kind of weird now that we're teaching people trigonometry. I don't think many people are raising barns. And if you're going to be, you know, a structural engineer, it's probably good to have that, but you can take that in college, right? So what we really believe is, look, again, if you look at how does somebody's life turn out, it's luck and the quality of their decisions. And we're not teaching kids these really fundamental decision skills. So the Alliance for Decision Education, we're what's called a field builder. We're trying to build this field in the same way that social emotional learning is a field that got built, or STEM is a field that got built. And the field we're trying to build is decision education. In order to, we think about as world domination, in order to make sure that every single child, from the time they enter kindergarten until the time they're done with 12th grade, is getting decision skills education so that they can be better decision makers, which we think, to your point about what stays the same, right? That's the skill you need in a world that's where everything is changing and information is crazy and it's hard to tell what's true and what's not true, or what the future might hold. Just as you're talking about, like, look, we have to be really focused on like building relationships because we know that stays the same. We know that in the end, the people who are better decision makers on average are going to do much better. And that's the thing that we can give our children to really make it so that they have just a higher probability of thriving in the world. And that is what we're trying to do. We want to get to every single kid in this country and the world.
Here. I am all in with you. I don't know how much I can move the needle, but I can promise you I will try to move the needle for
you. Field building is getting a lot of people to move the needle a little, and then the needle moves a lot.
Well, I'm going to do everything that I possibly can with whatever resources I have, because I'm wholeheartedly in and believe that decision-making and critical thinking skills, that's what's going to set people apart for the next generation and the future to come.
Thank you.
So on that note, thank you once again. I'm going to let you go off to all the amazing things you have on your Friday evening. But this was wonderful, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Awesome. Thank you, Zach. I'm so happy to see you again.